What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss.
On today's show, we'll be in conversation with the author of one of this year's most anticipated books. This one, only slightly out of character for this radio program, uses basketball as a vehicle for engaging the nuances of social life, from pride in a team city and following dreams that can be just out of reach to a relationship with urban abandonment, police violence, jails, and rebellion, all alongside nuances of love and grief. The book is called There's Always This Year on Basketball and Ascension, and it's a poetic love letter to basketball, also to being rooted in Columbus, Ohio, where the author has lived most of his life, and to the idea and experience of enemies. It's written by a MacArthur genius and also one of my personal favorite writers, Hanif Abdurraqib, who's a poet, writer, music and cultural critic, as well as a sneakerhead and a dog parent. I'm very excited to bring him to these airwaves. Hanif, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to get to be here with you.
Really, really happy to have you on. We're gonna dive deep into the new book, but I'd love it if we could start out with your own description of There's Always This Year. I just gave it kind of a take on it. I'm wondering, what's your synopsis for folks who really are not familiar with you and your writing?
My general thought with the book is that it began as a way to use basketball as a container to explain and explore uncertainties about the passage of time and uncertainties about legacy and mortality in place. A real, I think, driving force of the book is an examination of who gets to stay in a place and who makes it out. And what does making it out, or making it even, look like? You know, upsetting maybe the idea of what making it means broadly. There's a lot happening in the book, but those are some of its central themes.
And we'll talk more about making it out or staying where you make it in just a minute. This is your first book that is kind of about basketball, but not your first one where you use kind of a theme to explore social and life experiences. You've published extensively as a music critic and a culture critic. What led you to basketball specifically for this book, as opposed to, say, I don't know, sneakers or Islam or being a dog parent?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was interested in tapping into the supposed immortality of LeBron James, who is around the same age I am. We're about a year apart. We grew up in two different Ohios, but both in Ohio in the same era. And there's kind of a relationship with LeBron James, on the court at least, where he is seen as this kind of immortal, as though he might play forever. And, you know, the gradual decline, at least, it has taken long to begin. But that, to me, wasn't aligning with my relationship of human mortality and immortality, the kind of immortality that one might crave off the court, right? I don't know if anyone would or should perhaps want to live forever. I am not interested in living forever. And I'm not saying LeBron James is or is not interested in living forever, but he was a good starting point for me to bridge this gap between the imagination, the imagined immortality of the superhero who has been invincible seemingly on a basketball court, has been impervious to age for a long time, versus the very real idea of aging and growing beyond versions of yourself that you believed were possible. And so, you know, There's those explorations that I thought were good entry points for a grander conversation about time.
Well, and since we're talking about both LeBron James and time in place, LeBron is someone who has a very particular relationship to Ohio and to Cleveland, playing for Cleveland, being drafted to the Cleveland Cavaliers, leaving Cleveland for the Miami Heat, coming back, and then leaving again. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, certainly in terms of aging, in terms of mortality, but also in terms of what it means for you to identify with a team or a sport that's tied to a place, or even in this case, LeBron, who's tied to a place, and how it impacts your and people's relationship with that, with a place, when those things don't necessarily stay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the interesting thing about tying oneself to any team or any place, I think, is that you're almost like surrendering yourself to reality that you can't control. Mm. That's what fandom is to any degree. But if we're looking at it through the lens of sport, it means that you are really surrendering a portion of yourself and perhaps a portion of your happiness and pleasures to a real set of circumstances that are beyond your ability to control. And that, to me, is deeply romantic, but also deeply flawed. And I say this as someone who obviously is a massive sports fan. And you're kind of at the whims of others. And I remember when LeBron James left, you know, I think there were a lot of people who were upset for or performed a kind of rage and upsetness for many reasons. But the reason that most felt obvious to me was that it really very much seemed that people were upset about having lost control of something that they believed they controlled, right? They were reminded of kind of the fallibility of fandom. And I think part of that, again, for me, is really kind of beautiful that you can give yourself over to this world that you can't control. And, you know, every now and then it will grant you with something magical, but that's not guaranteed, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I really believe in this process of you know, treating yourself to that kind of surrender, but there is a downside to it, of course.
I'm also interested in, so we're talking about kind of a personal relationship to a team and its relationship to a place. I'm also interested in how a team itself defines and is defined by a place. And I'm saying that because from a perspective, I've lived in Oakland my whole life. And so while reading your book, I started reflecting on growing up in a place that had professional basketball, baseball, and football teams. And like as a kid, I didn't have a lot of access to professional sports. We didn't watch them at home, but those teams have meant a lot to the basic foundation and fabric of how I think about my hometown.
Yeah.
And I don't know how closely you've followed, but in the past couple of years, we lost the Warriors to San Francisco, which, to be fair, is close by, but
it's not the same. Yeah.
Like a huge distance. Exactly.
Yeah.
We lost the Raiders to Vegas. The A's are getting ready to move to Vegas pretty soon. So we already talked a little bit about what it means for people to lose a team, but for a city itself that's maybe defined by and a team that is also defined by the place that it was in.
Yeah, my heart aches for Oakland. I mean, I have friends who are lifelong Oakland sports fans, and I really ache for Oakland because the emptying out of that sports history, which is rich, I mean, just like very vibrant, even if we just take the A's and the Warriors. There's a vibrant sports history, not just in its past, but in its very recent present. Mm. I feel like nationally, it should be a story that Oakland has essentially been like drained, drained of its sports identity, which is not like a fly-by-night sports identity. You know what I mean? Like, I loved going to Warriors games when they were in Oakland. I mean, there was nothing like it. You know what I mean? Like, and it's just in real talk, like it's just not the same now. And you know, love to San Francisco and all that, but like, it's not the same. I went to a Warriors game and it's like nice. Sure, the arena's pretty or whatever, but it's not the same at all on the interior, the vibe. And that's what happens because you take a team away, even if you move it just like, you know, 30 minutes in one direction, you lose an identity. And so it's been heartbreaking for me to straight up to see what's happened to Oakland. There are ways when that happens that I think people are made to feel like this is happening because our city is not worthy of having these teams here, or another city is more lucrative. Or gosh, I remember when Cleveland very briefly lost the Browns, and the way that was framed and the way those fans were treated, in the aftermath of that was so disturbing and upsetting to me, because it was treated as though those fans could not adequately love a team, and therefore the team had to go somewhere else where it could be treated better and loved and cared for better. And that just wasn't true. It, you know, so many of these decisions are driven by capitalism and driven by finances and driven by a kind of ruthless ambition. But the backlash of these decisions, the way these decisions are often framed, are treated as though the people who loved and rooted for these teams are not doing a good enough job. I live in Columbus. There was a moment a few years ago where our soccer team was threatening to be taken and be relocated to Austin. And it was clearly about cashing in on the kind of population boom in Austin and all these things. But the way that it was talked about was like, you know, oh, the stadium's old and falling apart and it's half full and they don't root for the team. And that just isn't, you know, so it puts this burden on individual people to mask some more, I believe, nefarious motivations.
You're listening to Law and Disorder on KPFA Radio. We're in conversation with Hanif Abdurraqib, whose latest book is called There's Always This Year on Basketball and Ascension. Okay, I want to move us along and talk a little bit about enemies. I'm wondering if, to start us off, you can just read the first sentence of your book.
Yeah, the first sentence of the book is, I hope you will forgive me if I begin this brief time we have together by talking about our enemies.
Why did you start there? This is a book about basketball and ascension.
Well, I mean, I think the book is about several things, but I do think that, you know, you kind of teach people how to read your work by laying down some very early stakes in the ground and setting the stakes of what the work is doing early. And to say, you know, the first sentence goes on to decode and deconstruct what an enemy is and how enemies arrive to us. And the conclusion that that has come to is that an enemy is anyone who disrupts the affections between us and someone or something or any world that we might love or have some affection for. And I use the Fab Five as a way to make that point. Particularly because I grew up loving the Fab Five and loving them in part because they were so eager and overjoyed to show affection to each other. And the way the media spoke about them was as if they were dangerous. And that to me meant anyone who would look at the affection that they were pushing upon each other and affix a kind of danger to it was an enemy to me. And so to zoom out and say, can't you, reader, believe that anyone who might try to strip away or alter or disrupt the depth of our affection must be an enemy, because there's no other language I can find for it. That is setting a tone for how to read the book. It is me saying, without actually explicitly saying, as we go on, we will encounter many scenes, many people, many infrastructures that are trying to disrupt the affection between a people and a place or a people and their people. And you will know when we come to those points that these are enemies. And I don't need to speak it every time, because we're setting the stakes early and understanding a framework through which, you know, we are understanding how our enemies live and what the motivations for our enemies are. And we can have a conversation about our enemies without having a conversation about our enemies, without centering them again. You know, we will center them one time and one time only by way of definition, and then we don't have to do it ever again.
It was a powerful way to start reading the book. Absolutely. I'm wondering if we could take one step back for listeners who may be less familiar. Can you just, for folks who aren't aware, who are the Fab Five?
The Fab Five were a group of freshmen, basketball players, who played at Michigan in the early 90s. And the Fab Five was composed of Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, and then two lesser known players, although one of them is my favorite of the bunch, Jimmy King, and then Ray Jackson. And they were known for a kind of redefining a sort of swagger, infusing college basketball, or at least helping to infuse college basketball with a kind of swagger. I think that to credit the Fab Five alone with doing that does kind of erase those early 90s UNLV teams And so I don't want to erase those UNLV teams. But they were kind of disruptors in a sense. One, because they were so young. They were, you know, no team had ever had freshmen in this in this sense, you know, playing in this way. I was young, too, when they were playing. But they not only represented this kind of heightened affection, but they represented this really sharp disruption. And that's kind of, I think, what led to some discomfort. But they were a joy to watch play. Even now, you know, while writing this book, I got to go back and watch a lot of highlights and clips of the old Fab Five era. And, you know, it's still a pleasure.
Absolutely. So coming back to our conversation about enemies, there's something in sports. We want a favorite team to win. And in order to win, they have to, at least for those moments of the game, make enemies out of the other team. You do something really powerful in this book, which I really appreciate how you explore the almost or very explicitly, actually, warlike discourse that comes around the game. Players referring to themselves as warriors and soldiers, the game as a battlefield. Basketball games are decidedly not actual war. Yeah. But I'm wondering if you can tease out the conversation with us here. How does the game play into the warmongering of our world where wars need enemies and violence garners attention?
Yeah, you know, I think when we look at, I saw a comment someone made, a sports fan who said something, or maybe it was a commentary where someone said, well, I look at sports and I realize like everything is war. And it's like, or everything. No, they were talking about, it was the inverse. They were talking about war and people kind of, as they said it, choosing sides. And they said, well, everything is sports. I thought, well, no, everything is war, or everything is lensed through the concept of war, because there are degrees to which that happens, where these binaries are created, and these battles are created. But one way that happens is through the simple division of teams and saying that other team is your enemy. And some of the language that I think encases these conversations that we have around sports. I mean, I played sports my whole life. I'm not really immune to that language. I've been a sports fan my whole life. I'm certainly not immune to that language. But it does create this expectation wherein the person or the peoples you are playing against are operating purely as enemy and little else. And the way that the language becomes crafted around this kind of at all cost, you know, win at all costs in these kind of things, it mirrors the language of battle and the language of, you know, the language of warfare. And I mean, there are also, you know, histories wherein sports have been treated as, you know, literal war. You know, players call themselves soldiers and these kind of things. And so, it's really just a translation tool for this kind of obsession, you know, this empire-driven obsession with war and manifestations of war.
Well, in many professional sports, at least, also have a direct relationship with, you know, the patriotism that fuels war, right? With starting games with the national anthem and pieces like that. There is a kind of some kind of a one-to-one relationship. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how using that discourse maybe, and this is just an idea, but maybe creates kind of like normalization of war making and like a willingness for sports fans to go there in actual war contexts.
Perhaps. I mean, I can't say for certain. I think that it's not just sports. I think our entire ecosystem is informed by the view of empire, which is centered on expansion, and expansion happens at a cost, and that cost is often war and or the lives of others and other in the lives of an other presented as lives that are less than, and therefore they can be discarded, whatever it takes. And so, you know, I think that's just the language in life that we are operating within, you know. And that's a tough experience. But I also think it's so embedded in our understanding of the world that I don't know if sports even accelerates it all that much anymore. You know, I think that the so-called war zones exist in many forms, and I think they will continue to exist in many forms and accelerating forms that aren't just sports. It's also vying for jobs. It's also grappling for things at grocery stores. It's these things that are very, I think it is becoming increasingly easy to project an idea of an enemy onto an increasing number of people, which makes it hard to live. And I don't know if sports accelerates that. I don't think it holds it back or stops it. But yeah, it does exist and further itself through that.
Yeah, I feel like there's a piece of it where war, literal war, the violence of war feels far away from a game, probably because a lot of what we have certainly in my and your lifetimes around war, we hear about war in Afghanistan or Iraq or Ukraine, places that are literally very far away. I'm wondering if you can talk about and maybe tell some of the stories you described in the book of how war making closer to home, that is like police violence, lands in a context of basketball and love for a place. And when I say that, I'm thinking about the ways you wrote about Tamir Rice, who was 12 years old when he was killed by police in 2014 in Cleveland, and then later the 2016 killing of Henry Green by plainclothes cops in Columbus.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I mentioned in the book that I think is real is that dehumanization is something that happens in a matter of inches. It doesn't all happen at once. And sometimes how that happens is creating the conditions of war. A city, for example, creating an infrastructure that leads to scarcity, that leads to neglect, and then naming the place where that is created a war zone. And then by naming it that, treating the people who are in it as people who are living in the midst of a war zone, which sometimes means that they are not as worthy of a kind of focused or intentional care. So that's one thing. And how that happens gradually is that it means that you begin to perhaps see people who don't even live in the places named war zones, but who maybe look to you, like the people who live in places named war zones, as dangerous, as a threat. And it eats away at the ability to interact with those people beyond them being dangerous, inherently dangerous, because they must be to have survived this place that is determined and deemed a war zone.
Are you up for telling a little bit of the stories of either when Tamir Rice was killed and how that landed in the Cleveland Cavaliers stadium, or your experience around Henry Green being killed and your return back to Ohio?
Yeah, Tamir Rice was killed right after LeBron returned from Miami to Cleveland that season. You know, and that happened in an interesting way because the city was, you know, yeah, Tamir Rice was murdered November 22nd, 2014, which was like early in the Cavs season when LeBron had just returned from Miami. And there was this overwhelming excitement in Cleveland that collided with this overwhelming tragedy. And as I write in the book, I remember the Cavs had a game that night. The Cavs had a game on the 22nd of November, 2014. And I remember the announcer for the Cavs vaguely mentioned a tragedy happening earlier in the night, but didn't name what it was, didn't put any kind of name or face to who might have been victim in the tragedy, didn't shape any kind of logic around it, was just kind of like, this tragedy unfolded in Cleveland earlier. And it was so bizarre to me that this desire to kind of hold on to the miracle and the mercy of LeBron James returning home, it felt like there were people, not just fans, but actual people who had, you know, people who were tasked with presenting the Cleveland Cavaliers to the public, be it announcers or whomever else, who were really fighting so hard to maintain this veneer of excitement that was kind of being propelling people post LeBron James return, that any kind of interruption of that with an introduction of this unspeakable murder would detach people from this dreamlike scenario of LeBron James's return. And that was hard to bear witness to, I think. That was hard to bear witness to. And I think a major vessel and vehicle for that final quarter of the book, which really deals around the city as its true self. You know, like, how do we get to the bottom of the city as it actually is, not the city as it sometimes pretends to be?
That's the voice of Hanif Abdurraqib in conversation about his new book, There's Always This Year, on basketball and ascension. You're listening to Law and Disorder on KPFA Radio. Hanif, we've been talking about your book for about 25 minutes, and I apologize for not preparing you for this ahead of time, but I'm wondering if you would be willing to read a page or two from the book to bring our listeners directly in.
Sure. Let me find a page. Okay. In Oakland in 2009, Black people were asked, how could you burn down your own neighborhood? And in Cincy in 01, Black people stood in front of glass, bent into a scarred web like a wounded moon, and they were asked, why would you do this to your own? And in Bloomington in 2000, white kids turned cars over when a basketball coach got fired, but no one really asked much. And in Los Angeles in 1992, Black folks stared into news cameras, their faces half illuminated by the glow from burning buildings disrupting the night. And someone with a microphone asked, why here, in this place? You live here. And in 1989 in Tampa, in 1980 in Miami, in any place where Black people have been conductors to a symphony of fire, in any place where there have been buildings once and then only ash, only the scent of hot wood or brick or paint, the question is always about how a people could do this to their own place. And there are many answers, and most of them are about how none of this shit is ours. And you have mistaken being in a place for having control over it. A mistake I've made before, but certainly did not make with a brick in my hand and bandana over my face. And it is harder to sell this on the evening news, but fire is a baptism. The fire says, get gone and we can start clean. And so then what isn't your own can become your own if it is all some vast and empty burned down nothing at the end of a long night. And I know this is not generous to the shop owners and the elders who have lived on a block for decades and wanted to die on a block that was at least close to how they remembered it. But what can I do to convince you that fire is not the villain, and the person who lights a match is not a villain, and the people cheering while a building burns aren't the villains? And there are villains, surely, but they aren't here, not among a people seeking deliverance. And the villain is an invention. Our enemies, the ones I promised we'd leave behind, those are inventions, but they are inventions born out of a heart's breaking. I swear to you, I would never take to the streets looking to watch something burn if my heart were not broken, if, through its breaking, I did not need to invent an enemy, nameless and faceless as a brick building or a glass window. Woven through almost every story of heartbreak, there is a villain, even if the name isn't spoken out loud, or even if, through a retelling of the damage, a person smiles and reassures their audience that there are no hard feelings. Tell me you haven't invented a reason to transform the beloved into the wretched, and at least one time to yourself in the quiet of a dark room when the weight of loneliness demanded you find a target, at least for now, at the start of it all.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One of the things that really consistently stands out to me in your writing is that you deal with nuance always. And while there are certainly things that come up that are more fulfilling or stronger or better, and on the other hand, things that are harder and sadder and heavier, sometimes tragic, you don't seem to get caught up in binaries. And I feel like this passage that you just read really brings that out. I feel like our world pushes us so strongly toward binaries, right and wrongs, in so many ways. How do you resist that and really settle into the nuances in your writing?
Well, I think I'm just curious. You know, I'm curious beyond binary. Some of this, I think, goes back to my earliest life as a music critic where, you know, I was getting albums to review that oftentimes no one else wanted to review, which meant that I sometimes didn't want to review them, but I wanted to make $100, you know? And so I had to start asking better questions than these binary questions of, is this good or is this bad? And the better question for me was, is this achieving what it seems as though the artist wants to achieve? Even that, asking that secondary question opens up a container wherein nuance can kind of flourish and bloom. And so I think a big part of me is just unsatisfied by any kind of binary reality. I find myself dissatisfied by anything that only has one answer. Because if there's only one answer, then that means there's only one way in and only one way out. And that feels suffocating to me. And I would like to afford myself a better reality than that. And so it, by extension, I would like to provide readers a better reality than one where there are only a couple options that are narrow and rigid. I think that is increasingly, there are some real actual lived consequences of having these rigid and narrow binaries that people are asked to adhere to. And so in creative work, I think that I almost owe it to myself to reach for something better. Part of building a new world or a different world, you know, I would like to see a different world. And part of building that is asking questions of depth and questions of width, you know, questions that expand. There's no reason that the questions that exist in my writing can't at least reach for a more expansive world that I would like to see in a material fashion.
This is very far from your first book. It's, I can't totally keep track, either sixth or more, because if we include, I don't know how many smaller publications of poetry books and a children's book that you have, but I'm wondering, in the writing process, sitting down to start this book, how has your writing process evolved to, I mean, it comes across so comfortably and like such a clear flow, even when we're making jumps going from the Fab Five and then talking about enemies and then talking about baldness and then talking about love, let alone talking about urban rebellions and police violence.
Yeah.
What's it like for you to sit down and write a book now, as opposed to maybe how has that changed for you?
I think that I tend to, I just trust myself more. Which is, that's to me the thing that unlocks everything else. You know, there's a certainty that if I steer away from something, I can at least find a way back. You know, if I kind of, instead of thinking about it in terms of I am building unique rooms in one house and I'm constrained by the one house, I'm thinking now I'm like building an entire neighborhood. And so thematically, right? And so I can leave the house and know that I'll return to it after a walk around the block. And that walk around the block will inform the many ways I can return to the house. For example, the many ways that I kind of enter the idea of baldness in that opening section, I think I move around a lot, you know, and I move around a lot, but I really feel like I stay grounded in this idea or this reality of the many manifestations of baldness and what that could mean. And so that for me is a confident action, you know, one that I don't know if I would have been able to do even, I don't, maybe even two books ago, you know. I think I will say, I think A Little Devil in America, my book before this one, really taught me a lot. You know, taught me a whole lot about how to weave a pretty expansive journey that doesn't leave anyone behind.
Reading the book really touched me, and I know that it's going to touch many of the folks who have the opportunity to pick it up. Earlier, we talked about a relationship between war making and basketball. I want to talk with you a little bit about what's going on in the world now. I know you've been concerned with the impacts of Israel's horrific genocide on Gaza. And I wanted to start by sharing with you that even at the beginning of this round of violence, must have been in October, I was personally very much struggling with what it means to be an observer and feeling super disillusioned still from the anti-war movement in the early 2000s. That was a time period that very much politicized me as a young person then. Mm-hmm. And it's also a movement that I felt let me down in many ways. But in October, I read some of your posts online about the importance not necessarily of using protest to win something material, but to protest so that there's clear record of dissent that can be pointed to. And as someone who is often very pessimistic, and I sure as hell still don't know how to find optimism about a free Palestine, I wanted to first off thank you for offering that clarity. It really helped me in some small and also some very big ways on how to participate in trying to create a better world right now.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really kind.
I'm truly grateful. And I'm wondering, I know the first part of this is just a big question, but how you're doing in regard to Palestine, and also many months after those initial posts that I read online, how you're finding value in protest and in dissent, and whether you're able to find even momentary spaces of optimism as people are trying to do whatever we can to stop this genocide.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not doing great. And here's why. I think I keep asking myself, is this actually the world we would like to live in collectively? And I think what keeps coming back to me is the majority, I don't know how to parse this, because it's disorienting, for example, that I think the people in my circle are shouting back no. But it does seem like the world at large, perhaps because people in power dominate the public sphere, are kind of like, yeah, we're cool with this, you know? And the only reason people are cool with it is because it's brown folks, because it's Muslim folks, because it's, you know what I mean? If this were a European country that this were happening to, if the victims of this genocide did not look like Palestinians, you know, victims of what was happening in Sudan did not look like Sudanese folks, there would be, I mean, the sheer knowledge of how different it would be is just, quite frankly, debilitating. You know, and that's hard. That's really hard. And it's immensely disorienting. And it feels like I'm in a different world at times. I'm not so much let down by the infrastructures of power in America, because I don't expect anything from those folks. But I'm really let down by just, I don't really believe in shared humanity or whatever that means, but I am let down by just the broad specter of humanity and the scope of humanity that would allow where like life can go on. And I get that we all have things we tend to. I am literally on like a press tour for a book. Like I get all the things that we tend to that don't require, or that make it hard to perhaps sink into bed into the depths of despair as I want to most days. But it's also like, it feels like not enough of the world is stopping. Every time, you know, there are people being starved to death right now. As we speak, people are being starved to death. And the sheer knowledge of that should at least stop some major movements through the world. It should be so upsetting that no politician should be able to leave their home. You know, politicians should be barricaded in their home, anxious about what leaving would mean for them, because people will follow them everywhere and harass them until they put a stop to this, you know? But instead, I think people are so beholden to these power structures and the people who uphold them that they don't really understand, or maybe they do understand, but just don't care about the level of complicity that places all of us in, even those of us who are maybe not as beholden to those political systems, but who do pay taxes. And so that's distressing. In terms of protest and political action, you know, I too was disillusioned by the anti-war movement in the early 2000s, and that is something that radicalized me, but my disillusionment radicalized me. Mm-hmm. That is also, though, you know, I have that movement. I credit that movement for learning more about Palestine at an early age, at a young age, you know. So I did not come to Palestine, you know, new on October 7th. Not saying, I actually don't think there's, you know, not devaluing anyone who did, because you arrive when you arrive and there's a lot to learn and there's a lot all of us don't know, all these things. But what I'm saying is having a political framework for what it actually takes to offers some reprieve or some freedom to an oppressed and occupied people, and seeing how far, how little that needle has actually moved in all that time, that is also distressing. And I think it pushes me to consider the limits of both witness and the limits of protest action. But I do really believe in making a public record. And I do really believe that a public record must stand. And that is, even as I am aware of and deeply in touch with the limitations of public record making, you know, I think it still has to be done. And I also think, I mean, I will say, you know, I'm fortunate to live in Columbus, where there's, you know, a lot of actions taking place outside of just protest action. And it tends to mean that, you know, protest isn't the only thing. There's also ways to uplift Palestinian art makers and art. There's also ways to have events that are educational, that bring people on board, because what actually needs to be built through this too is collective power. Maybe not collective power for the immediate stoppage of anything today, but collective power to prevent the next things coming.
Absolutely, absolutely. As we begin to wind down the interview, it doesn't feel like a good time in the world exactly to wish you a happy Ramadan, but I've learned that Ramadan Kareem roughly translates to "May Ramadan be generous to you."
Yes.
And so I hope for you and for all of us, we can experience this month with generosity. I'm wondering how Ramadan this year is landing for you, and perhaps differently from other years.
I mean, one big difference is that I'm reconsidering sacrifice on a global scale. I sometimes think that my relationship with sacrifice during Ramadan becomes kind of self-focused, where it's like I'm honing in on what sacrifice means to me or what my sacrifices are. But there's a difference between sacrifice and necessity. And I think, you know, I'm acting out of necessity, you know, out of a desire for necessity, and or out of a requirement for necessity. And that isn't sacrifice. That is necessary. That is also at the core of solidarity. I believe solidarity is mightily important. And Ramadan is a solidarity action because you are fasting alongside the ummah, alongside the community, the body. And even if you don't know it, there are people walking a path alongside you that is not your path directly, but it's a collective path. And that to me cannot be sacrifice. That to me is community building and uplifting. And so I'm really expanding my ideas around sacrifice and what it means and what it looks like to sacrifice, as well as just kind of, you know, trying to step outside of myself and be a bit more selfless and thinking about how I can care more effectively for the communities that are mine, which is, it's a hard time to, individually, it's a hard time for me to think in that way, because I am spending a lot of time, you know, talking about a book that I wrote, but I'm also trying to make sure that I am operating from a standpoint that isn't just self-focused. And so it's going well so far, alhamdulillah. I think I fall into a rhythm and a routine as it goes. And I hope that is happening too. I mean, the whole plan with Ramadan, I think, is for me at least, to look inward and to take in a kind of inward inventory that has exterior results as the years and months go on.
Well, Hanif, I have quite a few more things I would love to talk with you about, but our time is running out. I really want to thank you for joining us today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
It was wonderful. I really appreciate your time.
And we've been in conversation with poet, writer, music, and culture critic Hanif Abdurraqib about his new book, There's Always This Year, on basketball and ascension.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.